Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. As you've been hearing in the news, the Democrats are on the verge of finalizing the Build Back Better or Human Infrastructure Bill. Most of the coverage is focusing on what's getting cut out of the bill, and we'll talk about that too, because that's part of these endgame negotiations. But let's not forget to talk about what's in it and how transformative it could be, because remember President Biden's goal, the biggest leap since the 1960s in how government helps to fight the decline of the middle class and income inequality. In a video to constituents over the weekend, the leader of the House Progressive Caucus, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington State, reminded everyone what they're fighting for that was in the bill proposed by the president himself before Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema started chopping it down.
We have to do everything possible to deliver paid leave, childcare, pre-K, community college, climate action, healthcare, affordable housing, home care, and a roadmap to citizenship for immigrants. The president knows that progressives are fighting for these priorities.
According to NBC News, over the weekend, things likely to be in the final package include universal pre-K, that's huge by itself, 4 weeks of paid family leave, welcome America to the world of other modern industrialized countries, elder care provisions, dental care vouchers, increases to Pell Grants for making college affordable for more people, and an extension of the child tax credit, which sponsors say is already cutting child poverty in half in the first months of its trial run, and funding to fight climate change. Would that add up to a new deal, great society? Would that add up to a great society? Would it be New Deal big? Would it be great society big? That conversation is just beginning, and of course we have to see the final package. But let's remember to talk about what's in the bill, not just what's coming out of it. With me now, John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He's also a contributing writer for The Progressive. And coming from that point of view, some of his recent articles in The Nation include one called Biden Should Be Selling His Plan, Not Compromising Away Its Promise, and Bernie Sanders Shows Democrats How to Deal with Joe Manchin. John, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's great to be with you.
First, you get to say if you agree with the premise of my intro or not. If those things being reported still in the bill are still in the bill, will it be a historically progressive set of reforms? Will it be New Deal big, great society big?
Yeah, it's pretty close to that. If indeed, you know, what you're talking about remains in, and that's really the battle here. Now, I think it's important to understand at a baseline, if they do the physical infrastructure bill and some substantial portion of the human infrastructure bill, for lack of a better way of referring to it, this is going to be one of the biggest investments in this country, both physical and human, that we have seen since Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. I think that's really the more relevant comparison to the New Deal. The New Deal was so sweeping and coming at so many levels that I'm not sure this quite compares. In fact, I'd say it definitely doesn't. But if you want to do a comparison to the Great Society, which remember, gave us Medicare, Medicaid, the war on poverty, and significant progress legislatively on civil rights and a host of other issues, yeah, I think that's a fair comparison.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. There seems to be an interesting last-minute public tug of war between Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Joe Manchin over the Medicare expansion proposals in the bill. This involves adding vision care, dental care, and hearing aids to Medicare, the health insurance program for people over 65. Manchin is reportedly negotiating those things out over price concerns, Senator Kyrsten Sinema too. Bernie Sanders says it's still in there. Do you know what's going on there, substantively or politically?
Yeah, I can tell you politically for sure, but let's start with substantively. There is little question that the vast majority of Democrats in the House and the Senate, as well as President Biden, would like to keep it in. that doesn't mean that only Manchin and Sinema want to take it out. There's a portion of, I guess, what you would call centrist, some would call corporate, Democrats in the House and the Senate who think it's just too expensive. And so they are pushing against it, both on a cost, you know, complaint, and also, frankly, because there's a lot of lobbying circling all around this. There is a likelihood, unfortunately, I think, that it's going to get cut back. The question is how much and what might be lost. And, you know, one of the things we're hearing is a suggestion that the dental is especially expensive. And so it, when you talk about the negotiations right now, you have this prospect that you might get vision and hearing, but not dental, or you might get, you know, some other combination. Also, there's talk right now, and I think this is very alive and very much a part of the debate, of giving a voucher to seniors who could then use it, maybe an $800 voucher that they could use to buy some sort of insurance, additional insurance that would get them vision, dental, hearing, something like that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where the play is right now politically. Now, the political fight is frankly a much deeper one. And that's between, you know, frankly, two different visions of what the Democratic Party is about. One vision is, you know, basically it tinkers around the edges, you know, maybe fixes and improves programs a little bit, but doesn't, you know, go big and go bold. The other vision is that it is time to for the Democratic Party, when it has governing power, and this is obviously the Sanders vision, to really implement a set of major changes that people are going to feel, that they're going to know occurred. And from a political standpoint, what Sanders argues is, and I think that Biden understands this, is that if you do deliver vision, dental, and hearing care under Medicare, if you expand many of these other programs, the people are going to feel that very quickly and have a sense of what it means to have Democrats in power.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you've seen that Biden's approval rating percentages are down in the 40s. They can always bounce back from that range, as we've seen with Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, for example. But it looks from the reporting on the polls like he's losing enthusiasm among the Democratic base, some people in the Democratic base, because he isn't going far enough or fighting hard enough for these things as it appears to them. But he's also losing the support of many suburban independents who thought that, you know, Trump was too right wing, but now think Biden is going too hard left. You're obviously coming from a progressive position at The Nation, but many Democrats are concerned that they will lose those recent gains in the suburbs in next year's midterm elections, and Republicans will actually take control of Congress because they see Biden, these independents, see Biden and their local Democratic Congress people as spending too much. That could happen even as base turnout declines because not enough progress. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how you see the politics of keeping Congress in relation to this bill.
Well, you summed it up very well. Look, it's hard. Midterm elections are referred to as cursed for the party in power. And the pattern throughout history is very, very strong. But one of the interesting dynamics to put into this pattern is the question of whether people have a sense that you are delivering. And if there is that sense, your chances in the midterms improve. And so right now, the Democrats are very, very vulnerable. There's no question. And you can find a pundit or a pollster that'll tell you going one route will destroy you. And then another pollster just across the street who will tell you, nope, going that route is the only thing that'll save you. So you're getting a lot of, you know, conflicting information, conflicting ideas that come in here. What I can tell you is history is somewhat instructive on this. When Democrats are in power and they don't deliver in a big way, they tend to suffer some of their worst setbacks. And there was a sense with Bill Clinton, whether people agree with this or not, simple reality, there was a sense with Bill Clinton that in his first 2 years in power, he tended to veer much more toward Wall Street, much more toward a corporate position. He didn't deliver in the ways that an awful lot of people wanted him to. And you saw this real collapse, I think, related to trade issues. And in 1994, disastrous result for the Democrats. Similarly, when Barack Obama came in, while he did a lot on healthcare, and you heard a lot about the Affordable Care Act, there was deep frustration as regards the economy, coming off the Great Recession. and a real sense that the Democrats in power had not done enough to address the economic pain of that moment. And again, in 2010, you see a huge drop off in Democratic vote in a situation where tremendous setback. So I would err, and obviously, you know, you're pointing out my political sentiments, and that's fair to do. I would err on the side of saying that if the Democrats don't deliver in a big way, if they don't, you know, show that they can govern, their chance of a drop off, one that would be very, very damaging to them, is more severe. And so while I do think chasing after the suburban voters matters, and it's a part of the calculus, I think what you have to put into this mix is this core question. Are suburban voters really disinclined to vision, hearing, and dental for Medicare? Are they really disinclined to paid family and medical leave? Are they really disinclined to, you know, extension of caregiving for seniors and people with disabilities? My sense is that the answer on that is that they're not disinclined, that if the Democrats deliver in a big way, if they actually come down with something and it can be felt in relatively short order, that these will be appealing programs, and they will have appeal both in urban areas and suburban areas and rural areas. And the final factor I'll put into this mix is, while we're talking a lot about what Biden is doing and what the Democrats are doing now, we do have to keep in the mix the reality of Donald Trump. And he is such a hovering presence in our politics that even in a midterm election, he may still be a factor as regards how suburban voters and swing voters cast their ballots.
In other words, don't let the Republicans take control of Congress because they might make Donald Trump Speaker of the House.
Well, that's been suggested, yes.
Yes, which is rumored because you don't actually have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker of the House. We did a segment on that recently with these rumors that the Republicans might in fact install Donald Trump as Speaker of the House, and he has not been discouraging that speculation if they were to take the majority.
Yes, you're exactly right. I think your point is well taken there. And obviously that's something you'll hear Democrats talking about as much as Republicans. Right. But there's one other factor too. Donald Trump, and again, I don't want to obviously divert us into a long discussion of Trump, but the simple reality is there's every indication he's running for president again. He's showing up in Iowa. He's making endorsements. He's, you know, very, very active. And so that becomes a factor. And so then we circle back to our question about what Democrats ought to do, how they should handle this circumstance. And I think if you recognize the Trump factor remains, then the question is, what do Democrats hold up as their alternative to that? Are they merely a managerial party that, you know, when they're in there, they, you know, Twitter's not as explosive or something like that? Mm-hmm. Or they are they a party that actually, you know, delivers a lot, that makes a real impression? And I think that notion of delivering is very, very important for mobilizing the Democratic base.
Listeners, we invite your calls. If you consider yourself a Democrat, an independent, a Republican, or anything else, if the Build Back Better compromise, the human infrastructure compromise, whatever you want to call it, comes out as being reported, will that make you more likely or less likely to vote for a Democrat for Congress in your swing district, if you live in a swing district, or anywhere else next year? And how's it leaving you feeling about President Biden? And for this call, and by the way, listeners, listen up, we're happy to announce that for the first time since the pandemic began, we can return to our usual call-in number, which is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Now, because of pandemic-related technical challenges that we won't bore you with, we had to go to a different phone bank since March of last year, but a welcome sign of normality, folks. Our usual call-in number is back. So it's 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for how you're feeling about this apparent human infrastructure plus climate compromise regarding President Biden and your local member of Congress, 212-433-9692 with John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. John, there was this meeting yesterday, as I'm sure you know, a negotiating session that included President Biden plus Manchin and other people. On CNN's State of the Union yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told Jake Tapper that Manchin, who of course is from the coal-producing state of West Virginia, will get his way on at least one big climate thing, eliminating the Clean Energy Performance Program, known by its initials, CEPP, but she also said a deal is just about done. Listen.
I think we're pretty much there now.
You think you have a deal now?
We're almost there. It's just the language of it, but it will be, it will not offend, shall we say, the concern that Senator Manchin had about the CEPP. But nonetheless, the point is to reach a goal, and the president's goals of reaching the emissions, the pollution, and all the rest.
Speaker Pelosi with Jake Tapper on CNN, John Nichols, the nation's national affairs correspondent with us. John, are you familiar enough with the CEPP, Clean Energy Performance Program, to say why Pelosi would have singled that out on TV as a concession to Joe Manchin?
I'm familiar enough to tell you it's what Joe Manchin doesn't want. That's simply the reality is that he's been very, very clear on his discomfort with that. And, you know, look, the bottom line is that there's a lot of initiatives related to climate in this proposal. And this one, CEPP does is that it uses a lot of pressure on existing power plants to stop using fossil fuels, or at least stop using coal, and to move to cleaner energy. And obviously that's something that Manchin doesn't particularly like for a variety of reasons. He is referred to as the senator from the fossil fuel industry, even more so than many Republicans. So he's put a lot of pressure on the administration in that regard. And I've got to tell you, this is really where these negotiations, I think, get very, very dangerous politically. Remember, we were talking about, you know, both the practical realities of this and the political realities. And I've got a piece going up in The Nation, I think it'll be today or tomorrow, about where I really did a deep dive into the polling data on kind of what generated young people 18 to 29, and particularly even 18 to 24, to come vote in 2018 and 2020. Climate is a huge part of that. Mm-hmm. I can't begin to emphasize how I think a lot of Democratic leadership folks who are in their 70s and their 80s don't fully recognize the extent to which climate is a motivating issue. And so that's why you're hearing Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden say, oh, we're going to take this element of the plan out, but we're going to try and do something else. The truth of the matter is, if you take this element out, you really undermine and slow down the ability of the United States to meet basic climate goals. And that is going to be pointed out. It already has been pointed out by a lot of environmentalists. And so this is a dangerous territory that these negotiations are getting into. And if you give Joe Manchin what he wants, you may get a plan, right? As Nancy Pelosi says, but you may get a plan that faces a lot of criticism and perhaps, again, I'm cautious about saying this, perhaps even some resistance in the House from some of your more progressive members.
Is there an argument for doing climate separately, that there's a messaging challenge that has complicated the whole thing for Biden and the Democrats? Because without climate, it's a social safety net bill. It's a social supports bill. They could sell it as, the universal pre-K and keep grandma out of a nursing home with more mm-hmm. funding for home health aides bill. And it's more straightforward, child care and elder care and some of the other health things. With climate in it, it starts to seem like the kitchen sink.
Well, I understand the theory, and when you say it that way, it sounds very logical. Here's the complexity of it. We don't have the congressional circumstance that Franklin Roosevelt had during the New Deal, or that Lyndon Johnson had in the initial stages of particularly the Great Society. What you've got is an incredibly narrowly divided House and Senate. The notion that you're going to bring climate or a number of other issues in a separate measure, that you're somehow going to address it down the line in some other way, is frankly unrealistic. That's why so much pressure has come onto this bill, Brian. And this is the way to understand it. In fact, you literally have people even now lobbying to put things into the bill, particularly as regards immigration rights and some other concerns, because there is a feeling that this big bill, done through reconciliation, so you don't need 60 votes, is basically the train that will leave the station. And if you don't have your major issues on it, there is a real challenge of getting additional progress. So that's where the pressure comes. And also, I would push back a little bit as regards climate. Climate affects so much of humanity at this point. It's not one that you necessarily separate off and say, oh, well, that's a different thing, or that somehow fits into the business pages of the paper rather than the front pages. The reality is that climate is on the front pages because of the physical and human impact it's having right now. And so I think it hasn't been well explained. I would agree with that. But my sense is that it's still, I would say the climate component has a place in this proposal.
And I think most climate proponents are pretty popular. There have been enough immediate, in real time, as you say, not just speculative about decades down the road, impacts of climate change on people's lives in different kinds of parts of the country now, that I think these things are probably pretty popular. But is there a way around politically this veto power, and it really is veto power, that Joe Manchin, senator from the coal industry, has just because they need 50 Democrats, all 50 Democrats in the Senate, and he is doing as what he sees as protecting his constituents' interests in a coal-producing company? How do you get around Joe Manchin? Maybe there's no
Joe
way.
Manchin. Yeah, and then remember, it isn't just Joe Manchin. You've also got Kyrsten Sinema, who has some different stance on some of the energy issues, but also, you know, it's the challenge of negotiating when you've only got 50 members, right? You could make one person happy, and then you make somebody else unhappy.
Yep.
And when you have such a narrow margin. So how do you get around it? Well, I think this is where the Democrats, and particularly the Biden administration, made a big mistake. When you've got something this big, this monumental, you move big and fast. And I think that the mistake was not in spending every bit of energy on communicating about what was in, what is in, or what has been in the plan, and why it is necessary. And I think that, you know, taking August off and, you know, taking a lot of September off and talking about a lot of other stuff, frankly, focusing on a lot of the energy, understandably on Afghanistan and all sorts of other things, the thread was lost. And I don't think most Americans know what is in this plan and know what it could do. And so I think the Democrats, they undermined their ability to build up the energy and the appeal to the plan that might make Joe Manchin feel like, oh, this is popular enough even in my own state, or this has enough traction even in my own state, that while I'm certainly still going to try and protect elements of the coal industry, I'm going to do so in a softer way or with a little bit more flexibility. And I'll note that I wrote a big piece the other day on some of the reaction in West Virginia. And it's important to point out that, you know, one of the biggest papers in West Virginia, the Charleston Gazette Mail, I believe, they had an editorial just a week or so ago in which they were calling Manchin out for, you know, kind of clinging to the past and not really doing the things that were necessary to bring West Virginia's economy into the 21st century. So there's debate even in Virginia. Or West Virginia, I, as president or as a Democratic strategist, if it was my deal, would have spent a lot more time, you know, building on that energy and trying to move Manchin that way rather than flying him up to Delaware at the last minute to, you know, have breakfast and negotiate away whatever's left.
We'll continue our late breakfast with John Nichols from The Nation, and we'll start folding in your calls. John in Newark, Karen in Manhattan, David in Irvington on Hudson, we see you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, we continue in a minute. WNYC. If you're just joining us, if you missed the news over the weekend, didn't watch the Sunday morning talk shows, things like that, you may not know that the Democrats are now saying they are really, really close to a deal on the physical infrastructure bill and the human infrastructure bill. It's going to come way down in price, the human infrastructure one, from Biden's $3.5 trillion over 10 years, paid for largely by tax cuts on wealthy individuals and tax hikes, I should say, on wealthy individuals and corporations. It's going to come way down to, it looks like, under $2 trillion with those tax hikes going away at the behest of Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona. There's a whole list of things that look like they're in, things that look like they're out. We're talking about it with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation, and John in Newark. You're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Good morning, Brian, and thank you for taking my call. For many years, Republicans, they have passed laws regardless how popular or unpopular they were. And yet, Democrats seem to be playing a complete different game. Republicans, they wanted Judge Connie Barrett. She was nominated and she got confirmed. Obama nominated Merrick Garland, and, you know, he was stonewalled. It was nothing happened to him with him. But why are Democrats playing a complete different game? If they wanted anything, they want something, why can't they just mesh together and just push it just like the Republicans do? And, you know, it bothers me that every time something comes up, Democrats don't play by the same rules.
John, the Democrats would say, and this is part of what we've just been talking about, I'm curious your reaction to it, that being the big tent party that the Democrats are, they have different members of Congress from different states with different interests, and they barely have a majority, so they have to make all these compromises to get the yes to yes at all in this session of Congress. Does that seem wrong to you? You think they could be going about it in a different way?
Look, the margins are close. That's something we can't.
Oh, wait. Let me. I'm asking the caller. I just want to get the.
Oh, sorry.
I was talking to John. I know you're both
Johns,
John.
Yeah.
John in Newark, have anything else to add on that?
No, Brent. No, I understand that part. That, you know, we need to. They have to play with their constituents, but it just bothers me that we cannot get our stuff together and just do it just like they do.
I hear you. John, thank you. Please call us again. Now, I think Karen in Manhattan is going to build on that thought. Karen, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. I think this is me.
Yes.
I was actually going to build on what Mr. Nichols just was saying about the timing and strategy, but really just mm-hmm. talking about the way that the Democrats don't seem to know how to communicate clearly. I'm 66. Everything becomes very complicated. I think they spend a lot of time on the blow-by-blow, the complexities of issues. And especially during the pandemic, I don't think people are paying that much attention to that stuff, except the people who, you know, the news junkies and people in D.C. But I think if they, for example, had explained that the money in this budget is going to be spent over 10 years, I think people hear these figures and they freak out and there's all of this discussion of inflation and blah, blah, blah. And you hear the Republican talking points repeated back all the time. And I think you don't hear any Democratic talking points besides, we're going to help you. We want this. This is good. You'll like it. You know, but it's very frustrating because I think if we do get this stuff passed, people get money in their pockets, they're going to be happy. But they don't seem to even, it's like we shoot ourselves in the foot every time. So,
Karen,
anyway.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, I've been saying here, the listeners are probably sick of hearing me say something to this effect, John Nichols, that they shouldn't call it the Build Back Better plan. What does that even mean? They shouldn't keep referring to it as the reconciliation bill. What does that mean? They shouldn't refer, and even the Democrats, to Karen's point, call it the $3.5 trillion spending bill sometimes. And the media is really egregious when they keep calling it that, because the point isn't to spend money. The point is to do these things. So why don't they call it the Send American Children to Preschool and Keep Grandma Out of a Nursing Home bill? But they don't do it.
That's exactly right. In fact, I have written quite a bit about this, and I think that gets to the heart of the matter. Brian, you're a pretty smart guy, almost as smart as your listeners. And so I will ask you this question. What was the original price tag on Social Security back in the 30s?
I do not know, and I certainly don't know in 1930s dollars, but no. You tell me.
Well, I don't know. What was the
Because they called it, Social Security.
Yes!
They didn't call it the X billion dollars bill.
Yes! And the same with Medicare and Medicaid. You know, it's in the 60s. The key to this thing is that, and this is partially a Democratic Party problem, partially because Republicans, I think, are much better at messaging to the, you know, kind of emotional sides. It's also partially a media problem. Media loves, and I'm a part of it, media loves a simple, you know, price tag and a simple, like, fight. Oh, these guys like this. These guys want to go less. These guys want to go more. It's hard to get around that, but that is the job of a president and of a political party. Whether you approve of him or not, whether you like him or not, Joe Biden has the most powerful bully pulpit in at least America, maybe the world. And it just, in my opinion, has not been sufficiently utilized to talk about what's in this plan. And so the polling data is mind-boggling. I just looked at data out of West Virginia, Joe Manchin state, where when you detail, when you literally go down what's in the plan, including the clean energy stuff, it's got a 68% support level. This is a Data for Progress poll. 25% opposed. Now, but that's not how it's being presented to people. It's being presented as 3.5, you know, trillion, and, you know, it's going to wreck the economy and all these other arguments. And it's not working. It hasn't worked at the level that it could have, in my opinion, if you had described it in the way that you just did a moment ago.
David in Irvington on Hudson. And I know, David, that nobody who lives in Irvington actually calls it that, but because there's an Irvington in New Jersey, too, in Essex County, I use the full name to distinguish. So David in Irvington on Hudson, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem. So I often call where I live East Irvington. I hope there's none of that in New Jersey, because I live up the hill. So what I'm proposing is that the main problem here seems to me to be that they're, you know, Republicans are they've kind of gone over the cliff generally. And my own solution is to that I changed parties. I joined the Republican Party, and so far I'm just like this foolish entity all by myself, telling people I joined the Republican Party, and everybody laughs at me. But I'd just like to propose right now. I'm about to spend $15. I'm going to buy a domain name that would say DemocraticRepublicanClub.com, and if this makes sense to the two of you, I would spend the money and put an email address on. And if anybody else wants to start off in a very small way, this is a solution of one kind, because the real problem here is the Republicans are not, the Democrats are not democratic enough. And even if they were, they're dealing with a very difficult adversary in this case. And they shouldn't be entirely an adversary. We're all, you know, eventually supposed to be on the same page. So that's my idea, and that's what I think I'm going to do. I'm going to, I've been talking about it, Democratic Republican Club, that's what's available.com. I'll set that up, and anybody wants to visit it, I'll probably have it going in about 20 minutes.
You know, I'm not sure I quite get it yet. Are you looking to pick off other registered Republicans who are alienated from how radical the party has become, or what's your goal?
Well, that would be the best option. The most likely immediate option is to find other people who were registered as Democrats who find that their input has very little meaning, because it's so difficult to make progress. And that's what this whole discussion is about. You know, there are all these great ideas, and in the end, they can't get implemented because something has really gone amiss with the other the party that I'm now a member of. It takes some time in New York State. They don't make it easy. But if you put in for it immediately, I think you would be probably in the primaries or next year, then you'd be able to vote in the Republican Party, which I realize is not a great option. And I had tried it maybe 20 years ago. I tried joining the Republican Party. I said, this doesn't work.
Voting in the primary.
Right. Well, it's not just that. It's at this point, it's more of a gesture. But, you know, get a few people together in a small town like East Irving or Irvington, New York. Something can start eventually happening.
David, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Westchester is no longer a swing county. There was a time that it was. But over in New Jersey, not the other Irvington either, that's definitely solidly Democratic. But one early test of this Biden Build Back Better reconciliation, call it whatever you want to call it, bill, as it presumably gets through in the next few days, may come in the two governor's races taking place right now in Virginia and New Jersey. Here's Governor Murphy on MSNBC this morning, getting ready to receive Biden, who will speak in the Garden State today.
President Biden is coming in today, not for politics, by the way, but for two very specific agenda items that are important to the country and important to New Jersey. One is expanding pre-K. We're leading the nation in doing that. And the other is infrastructure. In this case, the first step in building at long last the big project that will add rail tunnels under the Hudson River. Those are two examples of many that still resonate deeply with Americans, not just Democrats. And I'm confident that'll continue to be the case.
Governor Phil Murphy on Morning Joe on MSNBC. John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation with us. We're almost out of time, but you have an article about Murphy as perhaps the most progressive governor in America. And yet, in Jersey, which hasn't elected a Republican statewide since, I think, 2009, that race may be getting closer than Democrats thought it would be, according to the recent reporting. Do you think Biden's presence today helps or hurts?
Well, first off, I find it intriguing that the governor says that the president isn't coming for reasons of politics. I would suspect there's a little bit of reason of politics here. Look, at this point, you know, in the midterms are looking to be close in Virginia and in New Jersey. But most of the evidence is that Murphy is doing better. At least he's got, it seems to be, have a little bit more of a lead, is maybe even a significantly greater lead than what you're seeing in Virginia. And you ask yourself, well, why is that? And I think you heard that in what Murphy just said there. He talked about how New Jersey is leading the way in pre-K and in some of these programs about, you know, why the infrastructure program is really, really good for something that people in New Jersey want. My argument in the piece I wrote is first that Murphy has been a pretty effective progressive governor, but also he's really good at communicating about this stuff. And obviously, if he gets beat, I'm wrong. And that wouldn't be the first time I was wrong. But my suspicion is that Murphy will do okay. And one of the reasons for that is that I think he provides a model for how Democrats at the national level ought to be approaching things, which is doing progressive stuff, but also talking about it and explaining it and linking it into people's lives.
John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. We'll see what happens as this continues to emerge, and hopefully a deal gets reached and we all see what's in it, and then everybody can judge it for themselves in the next few days. John, thanks a lot.
It's been an honor to be with you, and great calls as always.